Now, the British had planned a nice little scheme which would demonstrate to the world the Egyptians were incompetent at running the canal. And they would have lots of ships just poised and ready to go through the canal once these pilots had been withdrawn.
Then instead of receiving, say, 20 vessels at Port Said, you receive 30, to make it more difficult for any group to carry on as pilots.
Exhausted, the 36 Egyptian pilots and whatever foreign recruits they can muster work day and night to deny Eden his wish and to keep the canal running.
We were working continuously. President Nasser at that time was on the phone, on the wireless, hour by hour.
The Egyptians succeed in keeping the canal open despite Eden's best efforts at sabotage. For a second time, the Prime Minister has been foiled.
The whole world was not expecting at all that Egypt would succeed in this severe exam. And some of the Western papers suggested that the Egyptians cultivate the Suez Canal area with potatoes instead of running the Suez Canal.
Eden is frustrated, but Nasser feels vindicated. It is now almost 3 months since nationalization, and the canal is still open for business. It seems Eden's plans to overthrow Nasser and wrestle back control of the canal have failed. The world can see no reason for war. Then, on the 14th of October, two visitors from the French Ministry of Defense arrived to see a gloomy prime minister at his country retreat, Chequers.
The French had invented the following scenario: that Israel should attack Egypt. Thereupon, Britain and France, who had forces in the neighborhood, should say, we cannot allow this kind of war because it will interfere with the Suez Canal, and therefore we are going to intervene and hold the two countries apart.
I happened to be in Paris. So the Minister of Defense called me in and he says, did you ever thought storming over Sinai? And that's how it started.
Eden is enthusiastic about this French plan. Not only will he be able to seize the canal, he sees a way to bring about Nasser's downfall.
You bomb Egypt, you create panic within the country, you link this to an invasion, Israeli invasion, and the new government will emerge, and Nasser will be no more.
As Eden is plotting in Britain, the rest of the world is trying to broker a peace deal at the United Nations. Eden has reluctantly sent his foreign secretary, Selwyn Lloyd, to meet with the French and Egyptians in New York. To Lloyd's surprise, the talks are going well.
He desperately hoped that he would be able to make real progress in these talks in the United Nations and was encouraged by the Egyptian Foreign Minister Fawzi's willingness to talk over the subject.
But just as it seems progress is being made, the atmosphere changes.
The attitude of Pinault, the French foreign minister, was very ambiguous. From the beginning, he seemed to be prepared to get down to real negotiation. But then, halfway through, he seemed to lose interest entirely. And we wondered what was going on and why.
Eden, anxious that no deal is struck in New York, telephones Lloyd and orders him to abandon the talks immediately. The foreign secretary, feeling he might be close to a solution, is exasperated.
Selwyn Lloyd probably thought that it was worthwhile continuing with these discussions. Might say, like Hans Blix, thought that he could do with a couple of more months of time to decide something very definite about the weapons of mass destruction. But Eden wasn't having it.
Eden has another agenda and instructs Lloyd and Logan to travel in secret to a Parisian suburb called Sèvres to finalize the plot with the French and Israelis.
Lloyd was desperately disappointed. but felt, out of loyalty, he had to do it. But it turned his stomach to do it, and he hated it all the way through.
The document agreed on here, known as the Sèvres Protocol, puts down in black and white the covert plan to invade Egypt and fool the world. At the end, copies of the protocol are presented for signatures. Patrick Dean, a Foreign Office official, signs on behalf of the British. But Eden does not expect his desire for war to be confirmed in writing.
We returned late that night and took the document to him in number 10. And his immediate reaction was, "Oh my God, I never expected anything to be signed."
When this document finally emerged 40 years later, it confirmed how a British Prime Minister had deceived the world and deliberately engineered a war in the Middle East. On October the 29th, the Israelis land a parachute brigade deep in the Sinai, as agreed at Sèvres. Nasser is awoken at 4 a.m. and told the news.
You can tell that he was surprised and not surprised. How? We were predicting that there would be an action against Egypt. But we have no information from Israel.
But the Israeli advance towards the canal is a fake, designed purely to convince the world that the canal is threatened.
It was about 40 kilometers from the canal, or 45 kilometers. But when you look at big maps, then you can say, the drop was not far from the canal. That was enough to fulfill the needs of the British to say the canal is threatened.
We didn't go into the motives and consideration of France and England, because our aims were clear.
The Israeli forces concentrate instead on destroying the Egyptian army in Sinai, which they have long seen as a threat to Israel's security. The attack takes Nasser's commanders by surprise. They are quickly overwhelmed and forced to retreat. The following day, Britain and France issue their ultimatum, as planned at Sèvres. Israel and Egypt are to cease fighting, or the two Western powers will intervene. Eden knows this is an ultimatum that Nasser cannot accept. On the evening of the 30th of October, the ultimatum expires. Shortly afterwards, Nasser hears planes in the skies above Cairo.
I was with the Indonesian ambassador, and there was the air warning, and then came the blackout. I listened, and there was the jet airplanes. And I said to the Indonesian ambassador, "These are British."